You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on news that made headlines around our region this last week. So today, our panel includes Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Nicole Foy, reporter with the Idaho Statesman, and Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Hello.
Yeah, happy Friday.
And if you're anywhere in the Boise area, it looks like a winter storm when you look outside. Hey,
there's
before we get
nice
started,
outside out there.
So much blowing snow. It's bizarre. So before we get started with today's program, we need our listeners' help because on Monday, we're actually going to be talking with Idaho Department of Health and Welfare Director Dave Jepson. We're going to be talking with him about the state's response to the COVID-19 crisis because we are coming up on a year of the first case of the disease being announced here in our state. So if you have a question or even a comment for Director Jepson, we want to hear from you. Super easy. You can leave us a message at this phone number, 208-426-3625. Again, that is 208-426-3625. Or you can email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. And we will hopefully get your question on the air. So that's for Monday's show with Director Jepson with Idaho Health and Welfare. All right, let's just get right into our roundtable. So, Kevin, the legislature and
yeah,
and
they're around
the legislature. They're here. Talk about what's going on with education budgets right now.
Well, it's kind of off to a start. The budget committee began with some of the smaller education budgets this week. They set budget bills for career technical education and the STEM Action Center. But this is all kind of the run-up to some bigger votes and some bigger decisions for the budget committee and ultimately for the legislature. Wednesday, the committee will take up the higher education budget and the community college budget. The K-12 budgets will come up on, I believe, it's 2 weeks from today. So it's March 12th, I believe, would be the date. But the higher education budget, I think, is going to be maybe one of the most hotly debated budgets this legislative session, and maybe one of the most hotly debated bills this legislative session, especially on the House side of the rotunda. A lot of hardline conservatives in the House have real concerns about higher education. They believe that higher education is overfunded and spending too much money and too much placing too much emphasis on what they describe as social justice initiatives and a social justice agenda. I think that's going to spill over into the debate over the budget when it gets to the House floor. I think JFAC, I think the budget committee, they'll probably come up with a number. How close that number is to Governor Little's request, we'll wait and see. But I think when this gets to the House floor, it's going to be a Donnybrook.
And Kevin, when it comes to this idea of social justice, we had Education Week at the State House back in January. For folks who aren't familiar with that, this is when all of the presidents of the universities come in, they present to JFAC, and this whole idea of social justice came up, right? How did the presidents respond to that, or are responding to it even now?
Well, I think what you saw in the budget committee, especially when Boise State President Marlene Trump was there, it was a pretty tense hearing. Even watching it over Zoom, you could see the tension. You could sense it as Representative Ron Nate, a very conservative Republican from Rexburg, who was on JFAC for the first time, was really asking some pointed questions of President Trump about a variety of social justice issues on the campus. I think that, I had a chance to talk to President Trump on Thursday, and I heard takeaway about the whole budget process and about what's really at stake here in the budget is she's wanting people to focus on the bigger picture here, that after all of the cuts that Boise State has had to make in terms of staffing, eliminating positions, furloughing positions, that they're at a point where they can't continue to do this much longer, that they're at a tipping point in terms of needing to reinvest in people, but also invest in academic programs. If if the budget comes up short of where Boise State wants to see it, they may have trouble just providing those basic core credit classes that students need to graduate on time. And that's been a big push at Boise State. If students sign up for full-time instruction, Boise State wants to commit to the students that they will be able to get the classes they need, the credits they need, and be able to graduate in 4 years. What Trump said is that, you know, if the funding isn't there, it's labor intensive to provide all of these courses and all of these core credits in a time frame where students need it. They may not be able to make that commitment and meet that commitment to students to help them graduate on time. So there are real stakes here for students and staff alike.
Well, and Kevin, it's fair to note as well that and correct me if I'm inaccurate on this, but my understanding is that these ideas of social justice and what is going on these college campuses when it comes to social justice, none of these groups are funded through state money. So
exactly, and that's been reported really over the past year and a half that these are not a lot of the funding for this comes from private parties. A case in point, the University of Idaho, there was a question raised during U of I's budget presentation about creating a diversity position in the College of Engineering. We come to find out that that position was funded not through state dollars. It was funded through donations. It was funded partly through a contribution from the Micron Corporation. I mean, these are programs that are being funded from outside sources because outside sources want them, because, you know, corporate Idaho is saying these are important initiatives to have on our college campuses.
And Scott, I want to talk a little bit more about education, but let's take it to the K-12 with the idea of a push by some legislators to bring school vouchers to Idaho. And if folks haven't read your opinion piece on this, I think it's a really good read, and people should be reading it. But Scott, talk to us about this whole idea.
Yeah, so this is a national, you know, movement, and a few states have done school vouchers, but it is coming to Idaho. There's a movement afoot now to bring school vouchers to Idaho. Already, we have seen a couple of camel's nose under the tent type of bills that direct public taxpayer dollars to students who attend private schools. The latest is from Representative Wendy Horman and Senator Lori Den Hartog. They introduced a bill that would use $5 million in state general funds to administer a scholarship program for up to 800 students who attend private schools. The bill would provide a scholarship to private school students in the amount of 90% of what would otherwise be spent on that student at a public school. That per pupil amount that we hear about. So, for example, Idaho spends about $6,747 per pupil. Using that number, a student would be given $6,072 to spend on a private school. Now, Horman is quick to note that none of these funds come from the public school budget per se. These are new ongoing state general fund revenues. However, that money could be directed instead to the public school budget. So, in a way, it is taking money away from the public budget. At the same time, Idaho is sitting on a $600 million budget surplus. Legislators are proposing to cut personal income and sales tax, and Idaho is dead last in per pupil funding in the country. So, and I think this bill is a bit of a harbinger. We're talking about spending $5 million of taxpayer dollars to allow students to use that money, some of that money, to pay for private education. There's another bill. It's a personal bill, so it's not, it's not going to get a hearing this session. But it's a personal bill that was brought by Representative Priscilla Giddings, titled "Empower Parents in Education Act." It's a sweeping bill, which Giddings herself writes in her statement of purpose, it would create the nation's most expansive education spending account program. So the state would establish education savings accounts, providing up to $4,200 to every student who wants to go to a private school. Giddings' bill estimates that Idaho would spend $72 million on private school students. But according to her bill's fiscal impact statement, the legislation would have no impact on the general fund because it would redistribute existing state K-12 education appropriations. So her bill actually would use money that would be otherwise earmarked for K-12 public education and use it for private school payments. You know, it's worth pointing out that Idahoans already have an option for tax advantage savings accounts for private schools. The popular 529 plan, which is usually used for college, can be used for private school now. And so that's a tax advantage pre-tax account that people can take advantage of. And I'm sure, as Kevin is going to talk about today, a lot of schools rely on supplemental levies. We've got a bunch of elections coming up for supplemental levies. We already have 92 school districts in Idaho operating on about $216 million of supplemental levies. So there's real evidence that our education system, our state legislature, is not providing a thorough, fair system of free common schools, which they are mandated to do in our Constitution, with some schools on four-day school weeks, some schools with supplemental levies, some without supplemental levies. So the bill is, I think it passed through committee, and Kevin can maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but
passed House committee on Thursday and should get a House vote early next week.
Right. And so that's Horman and Den Hartog's bill on the $5 million, the smaller camel's nose under the tent. But I think that this is a big debate that's going to be raging in Idaho in this session and probably in the years to come.
So, Scott or Kevin, have these lawmakers said, given any reason as to why families should be given vouchers to choose private education? I ask that because the argument can be made that that money should go into what's constitutional in our Constitution, as you said, Scott, is to educate in a public setting. I mean, make public education better.
Yeah, right. And a couple of the arguments is that, it, you know, number one is school choice. So if a family wants to send their kid to a private school, then and why shouldn't the money follow that child? So we are funding students per pupil $6,700. If that child wants to go to a private school, why shouldn't that money follow the student? The other argument that I've heard is that the competition is going to make public schools better. So in other words, if my local
taking money away from them.
Well, you know, the argument is that if my local public school sees their kids fleeing their school and going to private school, they're going to do whatever they can do to compete with that and make their operations better and try to keep students at their school. So those are a couple of the general arguments in favor of school vouchers.
Kevin, what's the likelihood of what happens with this bill?
I think it's quite likely that the Horman-Den Hartog bill will pass the House. Again, the House, I think, is a lot more conservative. A lot of hardliners in the House who I think are ardently in support of school choice and private education. I think the big potential showdown could be on the Senate side, especially in the Senate Education Committee. Den Hartog sits on the Senate Education Committee. She has, you know, considerable influence on that committee. Stephen Thane, the chairman of the committee, is pretty outspoken in favor of school choice. But I don't know how that committee shakes out. It'll be an interesting, I think that will be the showdown. I assume that this will pass the House. I would be very, very surprised if it didn't. And I think Senate education could be the defining moment for this bill.
Nicole, let's stick with the legislature. And can you talk about a bill that could grant driving privileges to undocumented workers? Some controversy around this.
Yeah, so this bill, it's not the first time that this bill recently has appeared in the legislature. Once again, Senator Jim Guthrie from McCammon in eastern Idaho brought, last year he discussed it and got a lot of feedback, I think is the best way to put it, regarding having something called a driver's authorization card, which it would allow driving privileges to people who honestly, anyone who doesn't want to apply for a current, you know, state license or the federal STAR card, which of course requires a lot more information for anyone who's already gotten their STAR card than maybe you're used to giving to get a driver's license. And so what this obviously does then is opens up the ability for several people who are here without papers, who are here and living undocumented, to get the ability to drive safely on the road and take driver's tests, participate in all of the safety measures that we expect all of our drivers in Idaho, but that many of these people can participate in because they are not here, they're not authorized to be here legally.
So Nicole, what is the controversy in the sense of why some people believe that this bill should not go through?
Well, I don't think it's a shock that people and that people would be necessarily against offering, this form of formal ID to people who are here undocumented. But some of the concerns that I've heard, and I know the people working on this bill have heard, this bill would address. You can't use it to vote, and even then, people who are here legally but are not citizens. They obviously can't vote because there's a huge consequence for voting illegally. But this bill would, this driver's card would not be allowed to, be used for voting. And also too, it's something that a lot of our neighboring states have actually implemented, which appears to be to some level of success. This introduction of this bill comes on the heels of an OPE report, a bipartisan report that analyzed what kind of effect this bill would have for Idaho if we implemented one very similar to one in Utah. And although the report says that they could not conclusively determine that this would improve, one of the things they're looking at was, would this improve road safety? They could not conclusively determine that, yes, passing a bill like this would immediately make our roads safer with more, less hit and run drivers if they're worried and leaving the scene of an accident for fear of being turned over to immigration officials. However, they did notice that certain factors really did improve after the introduction of this bill. Specifically, there were lower rates of uninsured drivers, lower rates of unlicensed drivers. And they also pointed out that when it, the average property damage claim for an unlicensed driver, an uninsured driver, is much higher. And so we could really be contributing to the safety of our roads, and just by granting driving privileges to people who are already here, already working, in many cases, significant parts of Idaho's economy, and who need cars to get to work, but who currently don't have the ability to do that under Idaho's current laws.
And I think what you said too, Nicole, is it's the insured part as well, correct? I mean, you have less uninsured drivers on the road. That is a trickle-down effect to every single person that drives.
Yeah, and it also too, when it not having access to driving privileges for undocumented immigrants can be very difficult for a number of reasons, and just that it's another way that people are living in the shadows. That's something that there's a parallel effort by a large groups of activists who have been working on a campaign that matches in nicely with this bill. They've been working on it since last year. It's called Manejando Sin Miedo, which is driving without fear. Just that, and one of their claims is that it's very important as a society that's very interconnected that people need to have the ability to participate in going to church, going to school, taking their kids to school or driving to work. And that when you don't have those abilities, it can really make the roads a little less safer for the people who you're driving with, but also it prohibits your ability to participate in our society. And that can be really devastating for a lot of people.
Scott, there's another bill in the State House right now regarding tax cuts. I think most people would think, hey, tax cut, that's a good idea. But what do folks really need to know about this particular bill?
Okay. So you may recall that Idaho's tax revenues have come in way higher than expected. We finished the year with $600 million surplus in the budget. And Governor Little included in his budget a recommendation for tax cuts. He didn't specify what kinds or where they would come from, but he just left that up to legislators. Well, Representative Stephen Harris of Meridian has proposed a bill that would drop the highest personal income tax rate from 6.925% to 6.5%. It would also cut corporate taxes, and it would cut the sales tax rate from 6% to 5.3%. So the sales tax rate is probably something that a lot of us are familiar with. 6% would go down to 5.3%. Mm-hmm. But his bill would also eliminate a grocery sales tax credit that all Idahoans residents receive. And so the Idaho Center for Fiscal Policy this week analyzed the bill and analyzed the impact and what impact it would have on various income levels. And they realized that the changes would be a negligible to nominal benefit for the bottom 60%. So most of us would get a negligible or nominal benefit, about $30 to $92 tax cut over the year. And then it goes up from there. And so then those making 66 to 100,000 would get about $200. Those making 100 to 200 would get about $464. Those making $200 to $500,000 would get more like $1,000 off their taxes. And then the top 1%, those with incomes of $482,000 and above, would see a tax cut of about $4,573. So, Idaho already is kind of a slightly regressive state in terms of overall tax burden. Those in the lower tax brackets already pay a greater percentage of their income in taxes than those who make more money. And this bill would exacerbate, or at the very least, it would hinder, efforts to make our tax system less regressive and ease the burden on lower income folks. And so this bill wouldn't really do anything to help that. And then the other part of this is that the impact on the state tax revenues is anywhere from $240 million to $270 million. So we'd be reducing our tax revenue at the state level by about, $250 million. And there are some who are concerned about cutting taxes in general, these ongoing permanent tax cuts that are kind of propped up by this flood. We're talking billions of dollars in federal relief money from the coronavirus relief packages. Not only did the state government directly get $1.25 billion, but there are a couple more billion dollars that Idaho businesses and residents have received directly from the federal government in unemployment and business incentive money from the federal government. So there's some sense that that $600 million surplus is a little bit propped up and inflated, and then cutting taxes to begin with is not the right thing to do without knowing what those ongoing expenses are going to be. And then on top of that, this particular tax package, the way it's structured, is actually not going to help the folks who probably need it more than anybody coming out of the pandemic.
So where are we in regards to where this bill is in the state house, Scott?
So it got printed and it has been referred to the House Taxation and Revenue Committee. It has not received a hearing yet, but as far as I can tell, that's the leading tax cut proposal that's been put out there so far. So I expect there to be a hearing on it soon, but I just don't know when. Nothing's been scheduled yet.
Okay. Kevin, we briefly mentioned this in the last segment about some upcoming elections with schools. Can you talk about this? I mean, especially as we had the big conversation about school choice and all of that, and what school districts rely on to get money for their schools. I mean, this is a big deal.
It is a big deal, and it ties in not only to what we were talking about school funding, but it also ties into what Scott was just talking about this proposed tax cut. Voters across Idaho are going to go to the polls on March 9th, and they're going to decide on $298 million worth of school ballot measures. Now, a lot of those are bond issues, those are long-term debt for buildings, but a lot of them are levies, and a lot of them are supplemental levies that school districts have to get reapproved every year or two that they're using for day-to-day operations, teacher salary, technology in the classroom, which has become all the more important the past year, school safety, curriculum, textbooks, you know, extracurricular activities, what have you. Most of these supplemental levies have been on the books for several years. The amounts kind of go up or down depending on what the individual school district feels like they need at this given point in time. But 92 school districts have supplemental levies. Most, you know, many of these will be back on the ballot in March. You know, this is a big cog in the way we fund education in the state, and a lot of educators have been concerned for a long time that it's not predictable. You have to go back to the voters every year or two. You have to get approval. Usually it happens. It doesn't always happen. It's a tenuous situation, and a lot of school officials have been worried about that. And I think when they hear about a proposed tax cut that, you know, Scott talked about, maybe taking $270 million out of the revenue stream at the state level, that could have a very immediate effect on what's available for K-12.
What are some of the notable elections that we should be keeping our eye on with these school levies?
The biggest ones are really not within this listenership area. Bonneville in eastern Idaho is looking for about $50 million worth of levies. Coeur d'Alene is looking at a $40 million supplemental levy. But you do have some projects closer to home. McCall has a bond issue that's coming up to modernize a couple of its schools. You know, we have a full list at IdahoEdNews.org, so you can see what's happening in your local part of the state. But I'm 45 school districts out of 115 have a ballot measure, so chances are pretty good that your local school district is going to be looking for money next month.
Well, and it goes back to exactly what we've been discussing, Kevin, is that, you know, it's that need to have to rely on something that's not stable, right? It's up to the taxpayers to decide if they want to take a hit or not.
And this has evolved over time, Gemma. I mean, school bond issues have been in existence since statehood. That's been the way that Idaho has decided to fund school buildings since statehood. And you can argue the pros and cons of that, but that's just been the way it's been done for 100 plus years. The supplemental levies and the growth of the supplemental levies, that's a fairly recent phenomenon. Really, in the past 15 or so years, you've seen more and more school districts having to go to voters for supplemental levies. The number of districts has grown. The amount of those levies has grown.
And Kevin, let me add too real quick that really this came into vogue during the Great Recession. So in the 2008-2009 recession, what happened was school districts started doing supplemental levies when the education budgets got cut. But it just never went away. They've only grown in the past 12 years.
You're absolutely right, Scott. Two things happened at about the same time. You had, first of all, you had the legislature in 2006 reduce property taxes for schools and do this sales tax increase to offset it. It was then Governor Jim Risch's big tax overhaul that was passed in a one-day special session. Then the recession hit, and the effect really, really hit schools hard.
Nicole, just wouldn't be a reporter roundtable these days if we didn't talk about the coronavirus pandemic, but in particular, Blaine County. Let's go back to last year when Blaine County was a hotspot in the country. I mean, I believe per capita, they had the most number of cases, and it was kind of linked to winter tourism. Again, Nicole, Blaine County is a hotspot.
Yeah, and that was, we're kind of starting to see some of the same factors that contributed to making Blaine County suddenly spike in cases. I mean, I think for a certain amount of time in March and April, they had the most cases in the state and certainly made national news because of the huge number of tourists that were coming into the area, especially from places like, from big cities like Seattle and New York, where that also had early coronavirus spikes and really contributed to that spread in that area. And just, I want to be clear, the spike does not appear to be as dramatic as it was in the early days of the pandemic. But my coworker, Nicole Blanchard, has been looking into those cases rising. And I think it's one of those things where it's it's almost inevitable at a certain point when you have a lot of people traveling from different parts of the country and coming to a ski resort, even in places where, you know, skiing much more than, you know, something like going to a concert, you know, you're going to be much more spread out. You're usually outdoors, but there's still going to be a lot of contact, and there's going to be a lot of chances for the virus to spread. And so Blaine County has appeared on the state's, you know, quote unquote hotspot list for areas where they're seeing those cases start to rise. I would also point out too that it's, you know, it's hardly the only tourist area where that's you know, an issue. Like, there's already been, you know, reports of slight increase in cases in places like Teton County, which is, you know, right across the way from Jackson in Wyoming. So it's, you know, especially they're looking at President's Day, that there's a lot of travel to the region. And I think it's something that health officials are just warning we're going to have to weather until, you know, the vaccination rate is where they'd like it to be. And it's also something that, you know, we have two variants, much more highly contagious variants in the state. And I don't think health officials really know how to calculate in how much that is going to affect how quickly things spread in places like these ski resorts. So it's something to watch out for sure.
Scott, Interfaith Sanctuary, which for people who aren't aware is a homeless shelter in downtown Boise, they are looking for a new location. They believe they have found one. There's been a lot of pushback about this. We've had both sides on our program here at Idaho Matters. But Scott, kind of get us updated on you know, what some of the pressure has been like for Interfaith Sanctuary, but also apparently what's going on now with this move.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because this is really actually a story about the pandemic. This is an outcome of the pandemic. Shortly after the pandemic began, you know, as you might recall, Interfaith Sanctuary, in an effort to reduce the spread of COVID-19 in the homeless population, they were able to move some of their guests into temporary hotel accommodations at local hotels. And we met with Executive Director Jody Peterson, the editorial board, this week, and she said that because of the amenities that they were able to provide at the hotel, they were able to provide many more services that they weren't able to provide in their current location, including daycare and preschool for children, housing for private housing for families, private on-site medical services, a senior program for home health, hospice, in-person clinical visits. And so the idea of going back to their River Street location where they wouldn't be able to provide those services was like going backwards. And so they started looking for new locations, and they found this location, Salvation Army. They looked at several locations and nothing was quite right. The Salvation Army location kind of fit the bill for them for a lot of different reasons. You know, the expanded location would mean that they'd be able to serve more people. They're looking at the potential of 250 to 300 people, and including families. And families is kind of a big deal because there are 264 families with children on waiting lists for housing in Boise right now. And so being able to help families is a big deal. But providing all those other services too that they're not able to provide at River Street. But of course, even though this stretch of State Street is a busy kind of commercial area, there are convenience stores and bars, and there's a strip club down the street. You know, you might think that you might not know that there's a lot of residential areas around there. You know, the Salvation Army location backs right up to a residential neighborhood. And those neighbors really are adamant against it. And, you know, there was one person who said, you know, I don't want to sound cold-hearted, but I just, we don't want to welcome you to our neighborhood. And so Jody Peterson told us that she was kind of caught off guard by the neighborhood opposition, whether it was naivete or what. They didn't really expect to have so much opposition. And so they put the project on hold, just delayed it This week, they announced that they're not going to, you know, push forward with the city permitting process, that they're going to try to set up a meeting. They're going to try to answer some of the concerns. They're going to try to collect some data. They're going to try to address issues about property taxes and crime and police presence and loitering and crimes against the homeless. And they're going to try to put all that together and then meet with the neighbors. And then from there, take those responses and move ahead with the permitting process. I think they're still committed to moving ahead with this location, but they want to not only hear the residents, but they want the residents to hear them as well. So it's interesting. I think, you know, them putting the project on pause is a sign that they do want to be good neighbors and they want to be thorough about it. But they did sell their building on River Street, and so they do have to move out. And they do have to find a new location. So the clock, to some extent, is ticking, and they are eager to move to this building, which does check a lot of the boxes that they need for a shelter.
And Kevin, before we wrap up, you know, so many kids are either remote learning or in some type of hybrid model this year. And as we know, you know, a lot of things have been put by the wayside because of that. One thing that hasn't, there are certain tests that are still required.
Yeah, kids in Idaho are still going to be taking the ISAT, which is the standardized test that third through eighth graders and high schoolers have to take. The Biden administration came out with this plan on Monday, and there are some modifications. Schools can offer a shorter test. They can offer the test remotely. They can even offer the test in the summer or fall in some cases. But the idea is to run the test in some form to get some kind of set of data. I've talked to some state officials about this. I'll have more of a story about it next week. And they appreciate the flexibility that the administration has given them in terms of the testing. And I think they're looking to get some level of data out of these test results to get a sense of just what kind of learning loss we've had in the schools this past year. We know it's there. This will help maybe to quantify it a little bit.
I do think that's going to be the interesting part of it, right, Kevin, is to see what type of learning loss, as you said, that kids may have experienced, because for so many kids, it's not just this school year. I mean, everything shut down last March.
Everything shut down last March. We didn't really get any test results from students last March. So we've got this two-year window where we don't really know how individual students were doing. And in the aggregate, we don't really know how different student communities have responded to this pandemic. Is this more of a problem for special needs students? Is it more of a problem for English language learners? Is it more of a problem at some grade levels? Are some schools and some districts handling this thing any better, seeing any, you know, any less of a learning loss relative to other schools? There are a lot of questions at this point. These tests, you know, we'll give a little bit of data and a little bit of a sense of what's going on.
Well, I, as always, I want to thank all of you for all of the work that you do and for coming on our program on Fridays. So big thanks to Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman, Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, and Nicole Foy with the Idaho Statesman. Have a good rest of your Friday, and Idaho Matters. We'll be right back.